chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, the monument on the UNC campus that is known as Silent Sam is in the news again. And so is my friend Tim Tyson, who is, you know him for lots of reasons, but as our neighbor, but also as the author of the great book, Blood Doesn't Sign My Name. But he's a historian with appointments at Duke and Carolina, and that didn't keep him from standing shoulder to shoulder with recently with students and others calling for the removal, the reassessment, I think the removal of the Silent Sam statue. And so, Tim, thanks for, I'm really interested in this, in the monuments issue, and so are you, but maybe we got different views about it. What's going on?
Well, it's great to be with you, DG. Good to see you again, as always. Actually, I would say that the other day, I believe it was Thursday, the other day when we were at Silent Sam, I think it was probably the most successful day of Silent Sam's career because folks weren't calling for the removal of Silent Sam. You could get that idea from reading the paper. Mm-hmm. Some people would just as soon see that statue removed.
Right.
And, you know, 5% of me would like to drag it down with a logging chain.
Only 5%?
Yeah.
I don't even
believe that. No, seriously. Most people were not in favor of that. What it was a discussion. There were probably six different positions that people had, I would say, several. And then nobody was very set in concrete because it's the great thing about the discussion that happened at Silent Sam the other day was the acknowledgement of the complexity and the way in which we were actually engaged in a real exploration of history. So rather than sort of trying to obliterate our history or rewrite our history or back away from our history in any way, people were looking at the actual history that Silent Sam was put up to commemorate. Now, let me just talk about three words here. There's marking history, wanting us to remember, a call to memory.
An aversion like we've done recently with September 11th.
Right. We're not celebrating September 11th. And the discussion that we're having about September 11th has 27 different analytical points or more. You know, we're looking at it from many different angles and trying to see what does it say to us now? How does it look?
Yeah. Or a Civil War where 50 years ago, us white people celebrated. I mean, we've overlooked our loss, but we celebrated that the glorious time of our heroes, us white people, or some of us white people did. But this time, with a different perspective, we note it, as you say. We mark it.
Yeah. Or we celebrate, or we commemorate. You know, there's a lot of different ways. Now, I think the purpose of historical monumentation is to make sure that we remember our history, and hopefully, especially on a university campus, that we can actually have an honest confrontation with our own past and talk about what it means to us. It's not just to hoot for the home team. You know, that's a different part of the campus. But the monument is somewhere between the library and the stadium. It is a place where we think about the meaning of the past. And, it does indicate, I mean, typically, I think there's some misunderstanding, honestly. Some people seem to think that the only thing you do with history is either forget about it, because the same people who say, how dare you seek to obliterate our past by talking about the underside of Silent Sam, if you will, will, the same people in the next breath will say, stop living in the past. You know, we've got to go forward. This is not about, and that's an interesting thing, yeah. But it, you know, it's, because some people thought we don't need to have a monument up to white supremacy. We don't need to have a monument up to the Confederacy, which they were not saying is exactly the same thing. Some people would say it's unchallenged. You know, this monument doesn't actually ask us to think.
It's not a debate or a discussion.
Right. It just is a towering figure that says, rah for the home team, and the home team is the Confederacy, which was not, the majority of North Carolinians were not pro-Confederate. If you count African Americans as North Carolinians, see, we say the South, and we have this invisible parenthetical word white in front of it. But if you count African Americans, and then you add to that the anti-Confederate white North Carolinians, which was—
Or the pro-Union.
Both of those things. All the pro-Union people are anti-Confederate. Not all of the anti-Confederate people are really pro-Union.
Right. Okay, go. And you got charts to show these amounts, or are you just guessing to see?
We elected an anti-war candidate governor in 1864. In the middle of the Civil War, North Carolina, white male North Carolina.
I thought we elected Zeb Vance.
He was an anti-war candidate.
And pro-North Carolina.
No, DG. He said, and I quote, this was a war of the planters and the politicians, not of the people. That was his standard stump speech when he was elected. There were two anti-war candidates in that election. And so he actually divided the anti-Civil War vote with another candidate, and yet was still elected governor. So that would seem to indicate that there's certain uneasiness.
Well, now be reasonable in this assertion.
I'm being reasonable, DJ.
Be reasonable in this assertion, because Zeb Vant has worked his way into being the hero of the pro-Confederate contemporaries.
Isn't that interesting?
yeah.
If you notice that statue of Silent Sam, and I'm not talking about just Silent Sam. You know,
we got them all
I have
over
kind
them.
Of a soft spot for Silent Sam in a certain way, but they're all over the place. And I grew up loving those monuments, actually, when I was a boy, because they were about war, which
soldiers,
I found
soldiers and
exciting.
When
we played Civil War, nobody was a Yankee, heaven forbid. I certainly would not have been. I rode with Jeb Stuart's cavalry many a day.
The point that you were making that I challenged was that North Carolina was a majority anti-Confederate state.
Okay. I'll give you two moments in time. Before secession, there was a plebiscite across North Carolina, and delegates were elected to go to the Capitol and vote about secession. And you, to be a delegate, you had to say if you were for it or against it. And people, the vast majority of the delegates sent to Raleigh to discuss secession were announced candidates who were against secession. In fact, the anti-secession crowd in North Carolina before the war was divided into those who did not even want to have a secession convention because they did not even want to talk about secession, or those who said, no, let's have the secession convention because we are so much in the majority that we can kill this snake for good. So the anti-secessionists were divided, but the majority won, and they went to have a secession convention, and they were pledged to vote against it.
Well, this is all what you're teaching me.
So that would indicate in a very—
At that moment in time.
Historically documented—
Before April of 1916.
Before Lincoln called for volunteers.
Yeah. That's not fair
happened in between.
Our mythology is that it was only after the North became a threat to invading us or other Southern states that we jumped on board. But ultimately, we did have a secession. The date is May 20th, 1861. It used to be on our flag. And so North Carolinian, white North Carolinians, those who were running the state, did come around. And
no, afterwards, but the majority of North Carolinians, it is indefensible to say that the majority of North Carolinians didn't oppose secession. They voted for it, and that's only the white men. You think men are more or less
right, but
favored?
That's
only white folks. We're not.
That was first. What happened later?
What happened in between the plebiscite, in which the majority of white men voted against secession, and secession itself, two things happened. One is Lincoln called for volunteers. The other is the secessionist governor brought 10,000 armed men to the Capitol. And that Capitol, surrounded with 10,000 armed men, is where that vote took place. I think that had us a fair amount to do with it. But anyway,
Going to take a breath. I'm talking to Tim Tyson, and we're talking about monuments in the Silent Sand Monument, and the historian, Tim Tyson, is teaching me history. He'll do some more when we come back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Tim Tyson is my guest, and I always learn when I talk to him. It's on the occasion of the demonstration or the gathering a few days ago on the Carolina campus, is the impression that I got was that there were a lot of people who wanted to tear them down, and Tim says a few people did, but mainly it became an educational experience with a lot of different opinions expressed. Was it like a classroom, or were these people shouting and screaming?
It was a lot more like a classroom than you might think. It was more like a classroom than anything else, except that no single person was sort of in charge the way I try to be in charge of my classroom. Not that I try to inculcate people, but it was a little less orderly. But it wasn't a rowdy thing at all. And people, Judge Learned Hand, Justice Learned Hand, said the spirit of liberty is the spirit that's not too sure it is right. And that was the spirit that was in charge.
So there were
even folks who said they'd just as soon take the monument down, were openly acknowledging that it's kind of complicated because, let's say, for example, Saunders Hall.
Saunders was the head
of the Ku Klux Klan in North Carolina. He was responsible for the murder of a lot of people, the burning of a lot of people's homes.
This is after
he was a pro-Confederate guerrilla terrorist who was
also loved the University of North Carolina and supported it.
We're complicated. Every bone in his body was evil. I just said he was the head of the Ku Klux Klan, which is just simply a fact, and he wouldn't have denied it either.
He'd have been proud of it.
But we've got a building named after him. Now the question then is, do you leave it named after Klansman, terrorist, when you no longer think that's acceptable, and you could change it to Ella Baker Hall, Ella Baker who helped find our North Carolina great, who helped found the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and organized SCLC for Martin Luther King and built a mass base for the NAACP in the South in the 40s and probably influenced the course of American history more than most presidents of the 20th century. So, she'd be in the middle somewhere, and she wasn't president. But we could name it Ella Baker Hall, but that would obliterate the fact that at one time we named buildings after Klansmen. To rename the building is to deny a part of ourselves that we really ought to acknowledge and understand, not just condemn, but actually think about. We should ponder why there's an Acock Hall everywhere when Aycock essentially was part of a revolution that overthrew the government and disfranchised a violent revolutionary who endorsed mass murder, who said he would have gone to the Wilmington race riot, that he was on his way to it with his gun in hand, wearing his red shirt, which was a terrorist uniform. He was on his way to Wilmington to jump into the violence when he got the word came to Goldsboro that they'd already won.
To me, this is
the most beautiful
and complicated story about history, in that if you read Terry Sanford's biography, you'll find that hanging on the wall when he was governor was the picture of Charles Brantley Aycock, who was had inspired his mother and as a teacher, who had inspired him to go to the mat for education for all people. And so that our history is just cluttered with our heroes who were racist or who saw things differently from the way we did in terms of what it is. But their ideals inspired the people who helped, at least, to make the corrections. And it just gets to be complicated and when you start tagging people as evil because they were racist.
Well, the victors write the history. And, you know, George Washington, he chopped down a cherry tree and he could not tell a lie. You know, the man was a general, okay? He was a fine person, but revolutions curl these stories of heroism and purity around their icons so that we grow up worshiping folks that we ought to instead think about.
Yeah, no, that's interesting because, I mean, George Washington and Robert E. Lee are inspirational heroes, and we know that, or we think, we believe that if things had gone the other way in the American Revolution, George Washington might have been hanged as a traitor, and our history would have determined him as a terrorist, someone who uprooted the wonderful British rule or the British America and tried to disrupt it, and he was put down. And if we remember him at all, we ought to remember him as somebody not to look up to. And the same thing you would have thought with Robert E. Lee, because he lost, you'd have thought that would have been it. But this, you know, this duty and sublime, you know, all of these things that we grew up modeling our lives on Robert E. Lee, and you know, the model that we developed was pretty good. It made some potentially pretty bad boys into pretty good boys.
Actually, the story of Robert E. Lee that I was, we had to write in the third and fourth grade an essay on Robert E. Lee, and then we could pick if we wanted to write an essay on Stonewall Jackson or Jeb Stuart or another one on Robert E. Lee. I think in the fourth, you know, I was taught by unreconstructed Confederates, and it was very celebratory. But in fact, the virtues that were associated with Lee, as you point out, were really pretty good. I don't want to get into a discussion of Lee. I do think who actually is pretty noteworthy. But it's just complicated. You know, Aycock is a complicated figure who has within him actually a lot for us to learn if we're not so busy celebrating, because we can say, isn't it complicated? Isn't it rich that the white supremacist revolutionary who endorsed mass murder and called for terrorism and said practically his dying breath, his devotion to white supremacy, and yet he is the same person who did a lot for public education, who threatened to resign if the legislature defunded black schools, which they would have done without him probably. So we're complicated. We need a deeper discussion than rah, go team. And I think Silent Sam, the great thing about what happened at Silent Sam the other day was that we talked about our relationship to history and memory in a complex way. And we said, and ended up saying, how do we find, you know, that what we need to do is talk more. That was what was agreed upon. If you had to pass a resolution among that crowd of students, the one you could have passed easily was, we need to talk more. People came with documents. You know, they came with Julian Carr's speech, which he gave at the commemoration.
Tell us about Julian Carr, because he's it's Julian Carr. Who owned the mill in Carrboro? It wasn't named Carrboro then, but they named the. He's very much associated both with Carolina and Duke.
he had a lot of money, and people with money get heard, you know. But what he was saying at the when Silent Sam was
I tell you what,
put in.
This is a long story. Or I'm going to make it a long story because I've got lots to contribute. So let's take a break. We're visiting with Tim Tyson. We're doing it sort of on the occasion and the assessment of the gathering around Silent Sam that I had thought was to bring a bunch of radical people wanting to tear down the monument. And Tim says, oh, it's just a quiet classroom discussion about different ways that we should assess history. And we're going to continue our discussion after this short break.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin and my guest is Tim Tyson. We're talking about Silent Sam. And Tim, you're teaching me. And if I'm just arguing with my teacher, it's just...
That's what,
because I don't like what you're telling me.
No, you know, as a teacher, I'll just say this. You know, the purpose of history is not to nail up a statue and inflict truth from above, irrefutable, unquestionable truth from above. But what history is really about is a public, civic discussion about our past and how that might help us go forward. History is just a lot of trivia and meaningless memorizable information, unless you're thinking about what does it mean? How do we see that from here? How does it illuminate our path going forward? So the thing that was so great about that discussion at Silent Sam the other day, for example, I think the most popular idea, actually, because people didn't want to rename the building or tear down Silent Sam. If anybody did, it was a minority position. I mean, people did, but it was a minority position. Some people said that we should put a plaque up that gives a historical context for understanding who William Saunders was and what was going on when Silent Sam was put up. So we should provide a short written context, and that every 20 years we should have a student faculty committee and have them rewrite the plaques if need be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that we can, but that we wouldn't throw away the old plaques. So that rather than seeing—
What a great idea. Yeah.
Rather than seeing Silent Sam as just this silent, towering figure who seems to impose a pro-Confederate point of view, that instead you see, this is how we felt when we put Silent Sam up. This is how we felt a century later. This is how we felt 20 years after that. And not just how we felt, but how we told the story. You know, if you look at the history books, one of my favorite things I ever did was to get it was my wife's idea, I have to say, Barry, I'm not trying to claim credit. We went to the Historical Society. We called and asked them to get all the North Carolina history textbooks they had out. And we went and looked up the Wilmington Race Riot and the White Supremacy Campaign in each one and, you know, marked it with a yellow sticky. And then we looked through them in order and we saw how the story had changed over from 1907 to the present. And that taught me more about the kind of evolving understanding, what it meant to be a North Carolinian and what was our relationship to this complicated and tragic moment in our history than any sort of single truth imposed upon me ever could have been. We're trying to teach people how to think, to think first and then how to think, but not what to think.
Yeah. Well, you know, we got started on this because you're getting ready to talk about the moment in history when the monument went up and the remarks of Julian Shakespeare Carr, called General, because of his leadership of Confederate veterans organization.
He'd been promoted
from private,
over the years.
From private. But
after the fact.
Substantial and important man in North Carolina history.
Sure.
And so what he said should not be disregarded. A great view into what people were thinking about at the time of the monument. When was the monument?
1913. Now, if you tried to put up a Confederate monument in 1870, you'd have had a riot.
Because you might have the occupying troops. There were a few.
By that time, we didn't really have any occupying troops, I don't think, here. But maybe we did. I could be wrong. Maybe I'm picking the wrong year. But nonetheless, what I'm saying is white people were divided. When General Pickett got to Kinston in 1864 with the Confederate Army, the first thing he did was to hang 22 local white boys on the courthouse lawn for their support of the United States of America. Now, at Kinston in 1864, now at Kinston is not a huge place, but in 1864, Kinston was a tiny place, so 22 local white boys were hanged. That's everybody's boy. They hanged practically everybody in town.
As traitors, is that what
as
they were?
As traitors, because they were pro-Union. Now, because, Burnside had invaded North Carolina's eastern part in 1862, so people down that way felt more bold about being pro-Union if you were close to the federal troops. And he hanged these children of the South, and they were white. Nobody, if you go down to Kinston now,
there's no monument to those kids.
There actually is. Bless their hearts, there is. Now there is. In recent years, there's been a monument, a small plaque put up at the courthouse to acknowledge that. But, that's a piece of, nobody tells you growing up that tens of thousands of North Carolinians continued to be opposed to the Confederacy, that we had the Heroes of America, as they called themselves. Some people, informally, they called them the Red Strings, who were a guerrilla movement. Violent terrorists against the Confederacy all over the state, especially in this part. Upper Alamance, very, very strong with these anti-Confederate guerrillas. And that went on in the mountains where the Unionists were. There was bloodshed among white people.
Well, Tim,
so it's just a more complicated story. But in 1913, when they put up Silent Sam, it was a simpler moment because the white supremacy campaign had come,
had converted
and
everybody,
had won, and so people were retroactively.
So even Unionists were claiming Confederate loyalty, were waving the Confederate flag. Right.
I've got an ancestor, William Tyson, who was a Unionist and hid from the Confederates down at Maple Cypress in a cave up down by the river, and was sentenced to hang. And they actually caught him late in the war, and they forced him to join. They didn't hang him. They forced him to join the Home Guard. And then he was immediately captured by Union troops and went to a Union prison camp in New York, where he always said he gained weight in the Union prison camp because it was so much better being a Union prisoner of war than having to live under the Confederates. Now, he was an anti-Confederate, if there ever was one, named his son Henry Clay Tyson. But there's a Sons of Confederate. If you go down to my daddy and I go down to his grave. And somebody keeps putting a Sons of Confederate Veterans marker on his grave, like they couldn't catch him in life, but after death he became a Confederate. That's the kind of moment it was in 1913.
Tell us about that moment when Julian Carr comes to the
Daughters
platform.
Of the Confederacy were put these. If you look at the monuments everywhere, not just Silent Sam, but they're all put up in 1909, 1910, 1911, 1912, 1913, right in there. And it's a moment when the new social order, Jim Crow, white supremacy, black folks have been disfranchised and can no longer vote. So that the white folks who had voted with the blacks in the Fusion era had nowhere to go politically, but they've been, some of them had been banished and some of them had been killed, and a lot of black folks had been killed, and the black newspapers had been burned. And, that was over, and the dust had settled good, and we had a new social order. And in many ways, that Confederate marker movement is a celebration of that moment as much as it is the Confederacy. And, in fact, Julian Carr says, as he dedicated Silent Sam, said, "The present generation scarcely takes note of what the Confederate soldier meant to the welfare of the Anglo-Saxon race during the 4 years immediately following the war, when the facts are that their courage and steadfastness saved the very life of the Anglo-Saxon race in the South." Now, he's talking about the Klan. He's talking about after the war.
Right. And he says, the battle continued.
"When the bottom rail was on top," in other words, when black people were citizens, when the bottom rail was on top all over the southern states, and today, as a consequence, the purest strain of the Anglo-Saxon is to be found in the southern states, praise God. And then he tells the story. He says, I trust I may be pardoned for one allusion, howbeit it is rather personal. 100 yards from where we stand, less than 90 days, perhaps, after my return from Appomattox, I horsewhipped a Negro wench until her skirts hung in shreds, because in the streets of this quiet village she had publicly insulted and maligned a Southern lady.
So that's part of his official speech.
That's part of his official speech, which is in the archive. And I was so impressed. The students had gone to the archive, looked up the commemoration, gotten documents, and come over to the thing. It was not a, it was a discussion, to be sure, that was
that's pretty inflammatory. That stirs everybody up.
Even I was
respectable,
sort
of prominent North Carolinian, a very important and in many ways very progressive as in business owner and a donor to Trinity and then Duke University, somebody that was widely admired, although never elected to office.
Both of my employers got a lot of money from him. I really should not complain about him, but that's not my point anyway. But yeah,
the point is that there. I mean, this is if it weren't. I tell you what. Before to keep me from preaching, let's take a break, and because we want to hear you preach some more, and we want to hear what you're thinking about. I'm visiting with Tim Tyson. I'm getting really excited because, as always, I learn quite a bit, and there's a lot more for us to talk about when we talk about the Silent Sand Monument, which we'll do after this short break.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Tim Tyson is my guest. And I wanted him to come and talk to me when I read, or I thought I read, that some students, again, as they do every now and then, want to tear down the Silent Sam Monument, and you've squared me away on that.
One of the students, I hate to call him out by name, but I will anyway, because his is Alexander Stevens, who, if that name seems familiar to you, it's because his ancestor was the vice president of the Confederacy. And Alexander Stevens said, if we're wrong, said that the reason for the Confederacy is slavery. And if we're wrong about the Negro, then the Confederacy is wrong. But we stand on white supremacy, and that the Negro should be a slave, and that his happiness and his best interest in ours, and we need to be he had this organic hierarchy theory of how that things should be arranged in the world, which was common. But he was actually more thoughtful figure than most of the Confederate leadership. He doesn't look so, Alexander Stevens still looks like a person, an honest engagement with reality, even if we all disagree with him, or nearly all of us. Well, but nonetheless, his descendant, Alexander Stevens, is one of these students. And what they're doing is wrestling with the South. And another thing to bear in mind is that UNC has a lot more African-American students from North Carolina. Black North Carolinians are here at the university in much larger numbers than once they were, and even not so long ago. The university is doing a better job of recruiting African-American students, and there are a lot more African-American students here than there were when I was in college, for sure. And so people are wrestling with the meaning of our past, and that's what a university is for. And that's actually what historical markers should be about, is creating a public discussion, making people, rather than quietly accept and not ponder our past, making people think and remember. And then, that's what history is about. It's about a public debate, discussion, engagement, just consideration. It's not always and what happened there was really not all that. There was neither a unanimity of opinion, nor was there really a fierce debate, because everybody acknowledged that their own position, whatever it was not really adequate. If you tear down the statue, then you deny who we were, and you cover up something important.
Well, this is so interesting.
If you know, so that's why I like the plaque idea.
Yeah, I love the plaque idea. If you tuned in late, this is what to do about the Silent Sand Monument, and that is Tim's reporting an idea that developed from that discussion is that you have a marker in metal which gives this generation's view of what this monument means to us today and what we see in it. And it really is, I mean, what we're wrestling with, I guess I have to confess, you know, I'm older than, I mean, I'm getting to be ancient. And so
I think you're doing pretty well. I believe you've got several days left.
No, but my ties to my grandparents were part of this generation of Julian Carr and others who I see these as great people who, because of their times, and I wouldn't want to, I mean, I don't want to get too far out defending them, but to try to understand why it was that they were these great people whose ideals make me a better person even today, why they were so determined that the best thing they could do for their country and their children was to put the blacks in the place that they thought they were, which was secondary, and to keep them out of running the government, right. Keep them out of running important things, let them, we'll be kind to them if they do what we tell them to do.
They're like guests or like children.
But we don't want them coming in and citizens. Running government. Yes. And I mean, I've tried to understand that so that, and here's the painful part of it. This is what I wrestle with. If I'd been back there in that time, I mean, would I have been a Julian Carr? Or would I have been, you know, some unpopular person who was out of the mainstream preaching against my Anglo-Saxon heritage, you know, all of this. So all of this, it resonates. It's like a big bell ringing in my head.
To understand American history, I think it's, you know, its depth, its complexity, its pain, its importance. You have to understand what it means to be a white supremacist abolitionist. If you look at the papers of the abolitionists today, there's plenty of stuff, racial attitudes they indicate that you and I would think are in fact, we wouldn't vote for somebody who said something
right,
like
or
that.
Abraham Lincoln.
Right. A white supremacist abolitionist is as complicated as we are, and we all are. And so it's important that we don't, if you just put up a monument, it stands there silent, and it doesn't say Julian Carr, you know, was in some ways a violent racist in his description of himself, and yet he is a benefactor and patron and a community leader who had some gentleness and a family man. You know, everyone, when we say racist, that's a big box that covers, you know, the women who taught me at church, who held my face in their hands and said and loved on me and said and taught me to sing red and yellow, black and white, they are precious in his sight. They didn't, you know, who didn't want me thinking I was better than other folks. They were segregationists, almost to a person, because of the time I grew up in. And that's, I always just try to bear that in mind. It's not a, and so it's more important rather than slapping a label on somebody. I think it's important to understand them as a human being in their context, not to excuse, because they can be wrong in their context. And when we say, you know, that we have to understand the white supremacists in their context, typically a lot of people who say that are trying to say, let them off the hook here. But you have to remember that, you know, half of their contemporaries knew better, and that there was a substantial minority of their contemporaries, people at the time who had a better vision. And we shouldn't, you know, there's no monument to the fusionists over on the state capitol, but they had an interracial coalition, and some of them even, you're not going to believe this, DG, some of them even believe women should be citizens.
Yeah, no.
You know?
But then some of them did, but, right. But I mean, more, you talk about the complicated.
Yeah, but we don't mark
the
their
complexity
history.
Of the racist abolitionist. It's the complexity of the racist fusionist who were for good reasons, more economic reasons, ready to make an alliance with blacks, but they weren't ready to have
eat at
integrated
the table
schools
with them, yeah.
or eat at the table
yeah.
with them or anything?
Necessarily. Although some were.
Some were. Some,
there was a, but they were kooks, right? Nobody
well,
was.
That's my argument. You're yeah. persuading me that there were many
You're
who
right.
were,
You're
who
right,
were
DJ.
Better people than maybe my ancestors were. And I don't want to disparage my ancestors at
oh, no.
all, but
oh,
they
no.
they adopted the they went along with this get away from Reconstruction movement and get back in charge the way it was meant to be with white people in charge. And so I'm ready to, next time you guys get together, I'm ready. I'm not ready to put my ideas out there, but I'm ready to listen to theirs.
Well, you know, I think we need to, your ancestors speak mighty well through your son, Greer, who I see making an admirable mark in this state. And if his his legacy ain't all bad, that's for sure.
I think what
I'm really asking people to do as kind of a public teacher, and I think what a lot of the students are asking us to do, is let the ancestors teach us, but let them teach us with their whole lives, their flaws, their warts, their misjudgments, in addition to their finer qualities. Right? Let's look at them, and not to disparage, but to understand, so that their best light can be the lamp that we go forward by, not their worst lamp, not to just stand there stone silent as a pro-Confederate marker, but let's talk about it. So that's what a university's for, and you know that's what public life is for.
Well, I hate to end this conversation, but I can't think of a better place to end it with that comment. Tim Tyson, thanks for coming and being patient with me again as I try to
great to be with you as always.
How I live in this world. Thanks to all y'all for listening. Our guest has been Tim Tyson. This is D.G. Martin with Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.